All right.
Well, welcome to Hyphenated Life. My name is Andrew Darty, and I'm joined by my illustrious co-host here,
David Lomdieu. Today we're with George Mason, right? He's an old mentor, colleague, friend. He kind of checks all the boxes for you, doesn't he?
He does check all the boxes for me. I've known George for almost 20 years now. Back when I thought that the church was irrelevant and the church wasn't an organization I even wanted to be part of, much less a minister, I met him on Thanksgiving break in Dallas 1 year and heard him preach and thought, wow, I think maybe I should rethink whether or not I could become a pastor if this is what it could look like and sound like. And George has been a mentor, and when I get really pious, I call him a spiritual father, but a spiritual friend for sure, Anam Cara in the Irish tradition of soul friend, and just somebody who's deeply shaped my leadership and my approach to what it means to be in the church as a pastor. And now in the last few years, he's branched out and done several other creative projects, kind of like what we're doing here with Hyphenated Life. And so he has been a trailblazer for, progressive Baptists for the last 30 plus years, and doing that in one church is fairly remarkable and pretty unheard of in our day and time.
Right, not even Tom Brady could make it all the way to the end.
That's
with his organization, and is now in Tampa Bay, Florida, the beautiful west coast of Florida there. So so not only is he, you know, have a deep, close personal connection with you, but what he's been up to lately kind of seems like right up our alley here, where we mm-hmm. seek to toe that wall and break it down between the sacred and secular worlds. He has, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it, but what he's done with his podcast, the Good God podcast, has been really cool. And you know, I think a perfect guest, even if you didn't already know him, right?
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, the Good God Project is the podcast that comes under the umbrella of an organization, which is a multi-faith organization he created in 2018 called Faith Commons. The Good God Project, it's an audio and video podcast, and it's at the intersection of faith and public life. And so a lot of that revolves around the city of Dallas, Texas, mm-hmm. which is interesting because we hear all politics is local, is what the former Speaker of the House used to say in the 80s. And all worship is local in terms of the church, and in some ways, all theology is local in terms of the way we're connecting with our community.
Did you know I was born in Dallas, Texas?
You were born in Dallas. Wow.
I was born Medical City, USA.
You're a native Texan.
It makes me a Texan through and through.
Oh, cool.
It explains the one pair of cowboy boots in my closet.
Welcome to Hyphenated Life. We invite you to join us on this journey to explore the connection of the sacred and the secular that inspires us to become more fully alive. We are so delighted and grateful today to have George Mason as our distinguished guest. George has been the senior pastor of Wilshire Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas since 1989. He has been a trailblazing leader in progressive Baptist life for a long time. He currently is the lead advisor for the Baptist House of Studies at Perkins School of Theology at SMU in Dallas. In 2018, George founded Faith Commons. Faith Commons is a multi-ethnic, multi-faith organization committed to bringing faith to life by promoting the common good. You can find them at faithcommons.org. And one of the most interesting things to me from a distance is that he's also created the Good God Project, which is an audio and video podcast that explores matters at the intersection of faith and public life, and interviewing some leading lights in the city of Dallas. George birthed and directs a clergy apprentice program called Pathways to Ministry in Dallas. I had the distinct honor of getting my vocational start at Wilshire, all cards face up on the table here, being part of the residency program. And so George is a huge part of my life and ministry and theological DNA. He also contributes to the Dallas Morning News, often on subjects of public interest that intersect religion. He is a native of New York City, and you can't see it today, but he has a painting behind him as we record this call, a painting from New York City from 1932, I think, and maybe George can even say something about it on today's podcast. But a native of New York City, not a Southern Baptist at all, but I think he likes to say a Baptist in the South or something like that, but a native New Yorker, married to Kim, a lovely woman, and they have 3 children and 6 grandchildren. I won't ask him which is his favorite today, but that would be funny. George, welcome to Hyphenated Life and for taking time to be with us today. We're so, so glad and grateful you have done that.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to be with you, Andrew. Thank you.
Well, today, George has sort of a certain knack for not needing to over-prepare for things because things flow things flow so naturally for him. That's one of the parts that I'm not totally like him about, although there are many things we hold in common. But George, I thought today, I mean, it is so striking, I think, it would be to our listeners, many of our core audience so far, to hear that you've been pastor of a church since 1989, 31 years, that involves some amazing evolution, I would imagine, over that time. So why don't we start today? I'm just kind of curious about how you would describe your own evolution about being able to lead a church for 31, 32 years. What's the secret to your longevity?
I would say not doing the same thing the same way over and over again. You know the old story of the teacher who went in to complain to the principal because she wasn't getting a raise or hadn't gotten promoted that year. And she said, I've been teaching here 20 years. And the principal said, and the person who did get promoted or got the raise had only been there 2 years. And he said, no, you haven't taught here 20 years. You've taught here 1 year 20 times. She's taught here 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and I think that illustrates, you know, something of this whole idea that if you're going to stay in a place, you have to keep learning, you have to keep reinventing yourself, you have to keep thinking in terms of not only the continuity of your relationship with people, but also thinking about the moves that have to be made, the ways that you grow and change. And so I think it has to stay interesting.
I think one of the ways you've made it stay interesting, at least to me, being under your tutelage for so long, is, and I was just telling David this even before we hopped on the interview today, one of the things that stood out to me about who you were and what your journey has really been since then. When I first met you and heard you preach at Wilshire in Dallas when I was green and grinning and a total young grasshopper and ready to, you know, take the first flight out of the church at that point, what really impressed me was that you are somebody who integrates the things that you're passionate about in your work, whether it's art, you're politically astute, your work in social advocacy these days, your love of things that just are about who George is, and you've brought that to bear in your work. Mm-hmm. How have you been able to do that? And for some of our listeners might be curious about how you do that in a Baptist church especially. Bring all of who you are, the fully alive George, to your work in a way that probably has contributed to that longevity in some ways or most ways.
I appreciate you saying that. I guess I'm not terribly self-conscious about it or intentional about it as a strategy so much as just a way of life. It does seem to fit with the idea of our spiritual conviction that faith is always personal and incarnational. Jesus, of course, we say is the image of the invisible God, that God is with us in a particular person, in a particular people, Israel, through a particular people, the church. And, you know, you look at your church's name is Pine Street Church. It's a location.
Right.
It's a particular place. It's not, you know, it's not the street down the street. It's that street. And it's, and I think you're not me and I'm not you. And so I think all of these particularisms are really important because, you know, it sort of reminds me of, okay, here we go. The poet W.H. Auden.
Go for it. Yeah.
Right. Auden said about his poetry that he hoped that it would be like a good valley cheese, local, but prized everywhere.
Yes. Love that.
Right.
Nice.
So that is to say, poetry is always better if it's talking about particulars, not about generalities. And in the particulars, then you can generalize. You can find yourself in them. So I would say, right, over the course of 31 years, I've been, you know, more or less interested or passionate about this or that subject or this movement in my life, this thing going on, how I'm changing and what's happening in me. And it comes out in my preaching. And it's inevitable that it would because they called me, not somebody else, right? And there was a time when I was in my 30s, and now I'm in my 60s. And so, you know, it just is what it is. So all I'm saying really is that if you are authentically yourself, then the leadership of the church, the preaching, all of that will be reflective to some degree of who you are. And of course, the trick is not to become so self-absorbed or self-referential that everything ends up being about you, but rather there's an openness to other people to find their story alongside yours because you've actually opened yourself up in certain ways. Sometimes that's telling a story about yourself. Sometimes it's not even doing that. Sometimes, as you say, it's about a particular interest in history at this moment that somebody else is interested in history or of poetry or sports or of something happening at that time that you've been throwing yourself into, social justice matters or some such thing. Anyway, so yeah, I think that is a key. And of course, it does have the sense of how a church then begins to become more and more reflective of the consistency of its relationship to a pastor over time. That has the positive side of a cohesive community that understands itself in relationship to a consistent leadership team. And it also has, of course, the potential downside of a church becoming so associated with a particular person that its identity then could be in crisis when something happens, right? The pastor gets hit by a bus or falls off the pedestal in whatever way. And we all have seen that sort of thing happen many, many times. But I think there are positive things to come out of long-term pastorates, especially if you have a generally healthy pastor and a generally healthy congregation.
I love what you're saying about particularity, and there are certainly a few ways we can go about that. David and I were talking again before we hopped on today about Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House in the 80s, who said, you know, all politics is local. And you could kind of break that down into what you've described, you know, all worship is local, or a church is local, as you said, but the particularity of that and the cheese image from Auden, I love that. I'm going to have to circle back and keep that one in my pocket. But that's also the move of the particularity of I become we. And depending on who you talk to, I believe it's Malcolm X who once wrote, when I becomes we, even illness becomes wellness. So even when you're, and you're the one who really taught me about the power of pronouns in the pulpit, by the way. But so if we're not, even when we're not saying I, even when we're saying we, giving voice for the whole community, in some sense, we're still telling part of our stories there. And I think that's part of the power of that particularity, or that I becoming we, certainly in the art and craft of preaching, as you're describing there in part.
Right. And I think a lot of this, from the point of view of how to lead a church as a pastor, requires that you have enough faith and self-confidence that between you and the church and the presence of the Spirit in your life together, you'll have everything you need to figure out how to be the church God wants you to be. The thing that is so disturbing to me at times is the sort of Walmartization of the church, where there becomes this sort of generic model that succeeded in this place and became wildly expansive, and everyone became envious of this model, and now let's all go to school on that and turn our church into a sort of a satellite of that, whether officially or unofficially. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily take account of the geography and the demography and the sociology and the, you know, anthropology of a particular place and people. And so, you know, it we all go sort of whoring after the latest, most attractive model. And I think we should pay a little more attention to the uniqueness and confidence that should come from our training and history in our own place.
Yeah, I think almost what I hear there is a little bit, you talked about being authentic with who you are, be who you are on the outside, be who you are on the inside. I think that I was once given that as a definition of integrity.
Nice.
And I think that's a beautiful thing. And as you are on the inside always changing, then what you are on the outside is always changing. And you alluded to that as being a giving life to a longevity in a position. And then I'm hearing now also that can kind of exist organizationally, right? If you,
yes,
you work from that, if you work the wrong direction, then you're not creating something that's true and authentic and has integrity, and therefore it's missing out on some substance and really missing the mark on whatever it's trying to do. I know for me personally, music has been one of the driving things in my life, personally, from creating music, hearing music, listening to music. And that has been one of the most inspirational, impactful ideas in my life. And as I sort of grew from, I was a music major, I have a bachelor's and master's in music, and started here at Pine Street Church about 12 years ago as a bass section leader in the choir. And here I am 12 years later, not necessarily with a piece of paper from a seminary, but a lot of experience living in the life of a church as a musician and now as director of worship and the arts. And one thing we have done here is we've begun to incorporate what's considered secular music into a sacred worship experience. And for me, that comes from largely that's what's inside of me and what has impacted me and what led me there. And I think it's very much naturally become a part of our community here. We have it's gone from, you know, one song, maybe a Bob Dylan song that references God or Jesus or something 10 years ago in the middle of a service, and then a few months later another song that wasn't in the hymnal or in a praise book and then has kind of grown to this idea where we really embrace that as part of our identity here on the corner of 13th and Pine Street in downtown Boulder. And we have an annual concert slash worship service on Good Friday every year. We call it a Good Friday musical meditation. And we select a secular album from the oeuvre of classical, you know, not classical music, but classic albums that are well known. For example, we've done a Stevie Wonder album, Songs in the Key of Life. We did a Joni Mitchell album, a Radiohead album, a Pearl Jam album. And we take that musical experience and frame it within the context of a guided meditative worship experience. I'm curious about your thoughts on if that sounds right or wrong or somewhere in the middle. Because here at Hyphenated Life, we really like to delve into that place where the sacred and secular worlds can seem at odds. And we like to say that wall shouldn't exist and doesn't exist.
Right. So, you know, back to poetry again, it's Wendell Berry who talked about how there are no, let's see, what's his phrase? Andrew, do you know this one? There's no sacred or unsacred places. There are only sacred and desecrated places.
Yes. Yes. You know, that really connects well too to Madeleine L'Engle that we talk about, where we reference a lot. I think maybe every episode so far. There is nothing right. So secular that it cannot be sacred. Yeah. Same idea from Wendell Berry. Nice.
Right. Right. So, yeah. So I think, David, it's an interesting observation. You know, when you ask me a question like, is it right or wrong? I would say, we have to learn that there's more than one right answer to a lot of questions. I heard or watched an old videotape of a guy who was a photographer for, I don't know, maybe it was Look magazine or Life or something like that, back in the day. And he was speaking to the $1 million round table, which was like this old, you know, sort of salesman's club, you know, they sold $1 million worth of stuff or something like that. And, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, this was sort of a big deal, I guess. Anyway, he was talking about how for every great photograph that he took, that was printed in a photo spread in a magazine or a journal, he took, you know, maybe hundreds of photographs of that same scene. And from among all of them, there might be, you know, a small handful that were right. And some of them were more right than others. And ultimately, you have to kind of come down and say, you know, there's more than one right answer here. This one fits this better than that, and celebrate that, you know, not to say this other approach is wrong or bad, or this angle, this perspective, this view of things. Now, you know, that doesn't mean that everything is equally right. I think that's part of the whole process of canonization, say, of scripture. We have a canon of these 66 books. Most of, at least Protestantism says that. But, you know, it doesn't mean that there's no wisdom outside those 66 books, right? It means that the church across time has said these are the most right for the formation and shape of our understanding of the faith. And then we can read and appreciate great works of art and literature and spiritual wisdom and other traditions as well, but these are most right for us.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's similar to how we use it here at Pine Street Church, the idea of using non-traditional sacred music within the context of a Christian worship service. It's certainly from the very beginning, our focus has always been to frame it appropriately, right? So you're not just dropping it in because that's your thing now. You're saying, is there something that could enhance our experience of this common language that we have that comes from the Bible? You know, and for that matter, you know, every church has a different hymnal in the pews, and those are not, you know, made by some power on high or anything like that. So, and most of the music that we sing in churches, particularly communally, has been written in the last 100 to 150 years. So, you know, again, that's, I think, a sign of times change and people change and cities and towns and blocks change and the church as an organization and institution changes. And I think that's exactly it, that if there is a place for it, then that's, like you said, that's, if there is a right answer for it, there are wrong answers for it, certainly. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. If the case can be made for it being the right answer, then bring it on, so to speak.
And for the poet laureates out there listening, we were trying to get the Wendell Berry quote right.
thank you.
Well, at least Andrew was. There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. All need to find a place to sit down.
Nice.
I love that clincher.
Yeah.
So finding places to sit down. I think it's what we've done with Good Friday. Mm-hmm. Good Friday night musical meditation. The last 2 years, we've actually incorporated, George, a more traditional Good Friday liturgy that happens before the Good Friday night musical meditation concert that David was just describing. And it's interesting to me, you know, it's one of those things that you were mentioning earlier about not, you know, not selling yourself out, so to speak, of the church, just because what works in one location may not work in another, and that idea of particularity coming back. You know, Boulder, Colorado is different from Dallas, Texas, on more than one level. And so as we've been experiencing what's going on with these meditations, I can't help but notice, though, you know, is that the participation level for that Good Friday concert is very different than for the Good Friday traditional liturgy, you know? And I know that Jürgen Moltmann is near and dear to your heart historically and theologically, and the great German theologian. But it's one of those things where, how do you live, again, in this hyphen space? And Moltmann talks about the idea that there's this dialectic of relevance and this dialectic of identity. So if we're thinking about identity, what are we rooted and grounded in, right? This particularity. But if the more we cloak ourselves in the language of the church and in language and rituals that may not immediately translate to folks that don't have a connection to the church in some way, we risk relevance on the other hand. And so I think for me, that Good Friday moment of that liturgy and of the meditation really brings that together in a way that I'm only thinking about this right now, but that's one of the ways we do live in the dash or in the hyphen space as a church, in this whole mix of identity and relevance that we're constantly sort of you know, negotiating and translating from the church to the community.
I'm not sure this is exactly right, but, you know, David was talking about how we sing out of hymnals most of the time in worship, hymns that have been written in the last 150 years or so. And, you know, that's right, but you also have, in a place like Boulder especially, people who don't know that hymnal, right? So that's not a song that's going around in their head. They have a different kind of hymnal, per se, that is part of their canon. That's, well, you know, there's kind of a hymnal, right, that's happening in their ear of a different kind of music. And when they come to church, if there's no way to connect those two things, the disconnect is going to mean a loss of a potential relationship and community. So you're working that hyphen to try to get together the hymnal and the hymnal, I think.
It's, well put, it's yeah. So, yeah. Nice. I sort of, in a time we have left, I want to circle back to this Boy, particularity is really bubbling up. Specificity, particularity, location. So, George, I want to give a chance for you to talk a little bit. You know, we probably have some, eventually we'll have some common listeners, but for folks, especially in our Boulder community and here and yonder, that may not know about your work with Faith Commons, what kind of brought you to create that, and how the Good God Project, I believe, emerged out of that. Could you just say a little bit about your work in those spaces, and especially as somebody who's deeply enrooted in the Jesus story and in Christian tradition, how you navigate those rich relationships with faith leaders around Dallas that you have really created some powerful partnerships and friendships with?
Thank you for asking about that. And I think it goes to something that you said earlier about how you stay fresh and stay in a place for a long time. And you talked about how we go through different phases in our lives and are interested in new things. What energizes me right now in this chapter of my life, I guess you might say, is that while I have served a Christian congregation, a Baptist one of a sort, for these 31 years, and before that, even as a Baptist, I am especially interested in seeing America rise up and live out the meaning of its creed. Not just that all men and women are created equal, as you know, King said in his speech, but in referring obviously to the Declaration of Independence, but also that First Amendment, which talks about the equality of our religious traditions before the law. We have been historically a wannabe pluralist nation in terms of our laws, but we have been, that's only a de jure theory if it's not practiced de facto, right? Mm-hmm. So what we know is that historically, non-Christians have felt largely marginalized and tolerated, not celebrated as equal partners with a voice that's worth paying attention to. And, you know, we maybe have had historically more Christians than we certainly have than as a religious body than Jews or Muslims or other religions. But we live in a time today of globalization, of immigration, of intermarriage among religious groups. We live in a time when that is creating increasing anxiety in our culture. The feeling that there is a loss of Christian hegemony. Much of what's happened in the support of Donald Trump by white evangelicals is an expression of this anxiety among certain Christians that their place in our society is no longer being valued as for its primacy in shaping culture. That others are having to be deferred to. We can't say Merry Christmas anymore in public. What does that mean? You know, who's going to tell me I shouldn't be able to say Merry Christmas? Well, actually, that's not really the point. And it's right. It's more, well, anyway, I could get off. But you say,
okay. Go ahead.
Why have I moved in this direction?
Right.
Why I've moved in this direction is to bear witness through my faith to my friends who are Jewish and Muslim and Baha'i and Hindu and Buddhist and other religious traditions, that they matter to me and they should have a voice that should be heard by others. And so whether it's in the Good God Podcast or through Faith Commons, working together side by side and in a community together, that's what we're trying to say and to all contribute together to the common good.
Yeah, I really you used the comparison of the terms tolerance versus celebration. That's been a drum that I have been pounding for a while. That, you know, the solution to racial intolerance is not racial tolerance; it's right. Celebrating diversity. And it gets back a little bit to you know, this common tongue thing a little bit. When you bring all these diverse communities together, that becomes a challenge, and it takes energy and effort and passion and patience. You know, not everybody grew up playing Tiddlywinks, and so not everyone's going to know what that is.
You picked up on that,
yeah. And so I love,
for those listening who don't know, George is a theologian of Tiddlywinks. Just to put that in there.
Okay, but this is the thing, right? So theology is about everything.
Yes,
I remember. That's it. I remember when I was trying to decide on a major subject for my PhD work, I settled on systematic theology because I went to see my advisor, and he was talking about, you know, how you could do New Testament, you could do Old Testament, you could do, you know, Christian ethics, you could do, you know, all these different things. And then he said you could do systematic theology, but that's about everything. And so I said, okay, well, that's for me.
There it is. Yes. Yeah.
Yes. I think that it takes work like you're doing, and I certainly applaud that. And it's something that we talk about here, and we move towards that. And maybe by year 31, we'll have gotten there or closer to that. You know, it was Mother Teresa said, I love all religions, but I'm in love with my religion. You know, that sort of perspective could go such a long way in these times. Mm-hmm. And you're noting that giving up power is, whether you realize that that's what's happening or not, is a difficult thing to do for anybody individually, mm-hmm. and culturally. And what happens when you have anxiety and fear is you lash out. And so what's the solution to that? And I think what you're doing is amazing. And I thank you for it.
Well, thank you for saying so. I would say that it's not simply a concession. And I know you're not saying that, but I think for many people, there it may be a suggestion that by giving up some sense of privilege or priority, that there's, again, this sort of noble gift that you're giving to others. Again, first of all, we have to reexamine, I think, how much we have actually taken it upon ourselves to rob them of their rightful place by presuming to own the space, you know, on our own. But the other thing I think that's really rich is that you don't give up anything in faith that doesn't come back to you in so much more beautiful blessings. It's sort of like, you know, that passage that we think only refers to tithing in the book of Malachi, that if you give your 10%, then, you know, it'll come back, you know, it'll be crushed and pressed down and broken and come back, you know, many fold. Or like Jesus' words about how unless a seed dies, you know, it remains just a seed, but when it dies and then it can bring forth a great harvest. I think the church in America has to start to understand that about itself better. That instead of the narrative that, oh, we are dying because we don't have the number of people coming to our churches anymore, what can we do to make it seem that we are reviving ourselves? You know, what if we actually saw this idea of death as really just a gift of giving up to our neighbors this sense of love and relationship that we now are partners with one another? What would happen to us if we learn to see ourselves and celebrate that we, by giving up, are finding and receiving so much more?
Yeah, I almost hear in that Wendell Berry quote, where it's like we're playing musical chairs and we've been taking mm-hmm. up two seats at the in the game, yes. You know, and it's That's time right. to say, oh, there's room. You know what? Mm-hmm. You can have this seat. I don't need two seats in this world where, you know, where there's only enough sacred seats to go around. Other than that, it's just desecrated seats. So,
right.
Yeah, I think.
Who was it? Brian McLaren who talked about build a bigger table. You know.
There we go. Yeah.
You know, if there's not enough room at the table, build a bigger table.
Hyphenated Life is a production of Pine Street Church in Boulder, Colorado, hosted by Andrew Daugherty and David Lomdieu.
The podcast is produced by Phil Norman and executive producer Alexi Molden. Special thanks to our guest today and the Leo Hill Trust of Boulder, Colorado.